Good morning and welcome to Family Life. Your hosts, Selena Muhammad and Dr. Nadia Muhammad. This program is sponsored by New Africa Excellent, Barad Speaks. It's me and Allah, Rahman Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most gracious, the most merciful. I greet the listening audience in the peace of Assalam Alaikum. This week's discussion is family life. We're going to discuss community events. And we have Dr. Nadia Muhammad here with us today. Welcome, Dr. Muhammad.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to be back. And also, I'm waiting for the listening audience.
We are going to jump right in. And we're going to discuss an array of community events. And one of the things I wanted to start with today, my family and I recently took a trip to San Diego. And it was beautiful traveling through the country. The sand dunes were just remarkable. You have this sense that you're in the Sahara Desert. It's just absolutely exquisite. And in the mountains, you're traveling in between the mountains, and the elevation is going from approximately 1,000 feet to 10,000 feet. So you're traveling on roads where there's no guardrails. That was fun. Because you had to really take your time, and you're looking straight down, and you're down about, you know, you're up about 10,000 feet, so that was fun. So then we get into San Diego, and then it was just a weekend trip. And one of the things that was so prominent, you know, whenever you travel, it's an education. And because of COVID, we're not wanting to fly anywhere, so we, you know, are sticking to driving, you know, staying with that format. And we get up in the morning and walk through the neighborhood. It was downtown in the Bay Area. So fairly safe, and I say fairly because nothing is 100% safe. And you know, you go with a lot and, you know, you start learning the terrain. And through the walking, it was quite obvious of the homeless everywhere. And then when we started driving, I grew up in the New York metropolitan area, New York, North New Jersey, in that metropolitan area. And you certainly saw homelessness. You certainly see homelessness in New York. But I have never in my lifetime seen homelessness like this. When we would drive in certain areas for miles, I mean, at least a mile, mile and a half going one way, and then on the other side, another mile. I said, I've never seen Skid Row in my lifetime. In fact, I was questioning whether I was in a third world country or not. I've never seen anything like this before. They had little top tents. And there was just miles and miles of homeless people. And I think the thing, Dr. Muhammad, that was most shocking, all ethnicities. This wasn't African Americans, it was people of all national backgrounds, Latina, Asians. I was shocked. In 2021, to see this type of population. And it was interesting because there was some type to observe that there was some type of caste system, meaning that you had your hierarchy, your, so I was like, what in the world is this?
Mm-hmm.
The caste system allowed some homeless folks to live in outside of parks that could not go into the parks. I'm sure it's because of different mandates, but they were near the parks, that outside of the park. But those particular people, they had pop tents, but they had lawn chairs. But you could see the lawn chairs were heavily worn. They had, you know, whatever possessions they had there. You could tell they were homeless, but they weren't on that Skid Row, you know, area. And I'm saying to myself, this is real. I have worked with the homeless populations in various communities, but I never seen anything like this before. Dr. Muhammad, what has your experience been with the homeless?
That what you're saying is, in terms of homelessness, that's something that's on the rise, and I think that's something that we're going to see more of, unfortunately, because when you think about it from a public health perspective, you think about financial strains like debt or unemployment that are significant risk factors for becoming homeless. And so when that's happening in the society that we're living in, post-COVID-19 pandemic, more people are becoming unemployed, more people are, you know, becoming more in debt, which, again, caused people to, you know, deal with this type of lifestyle. And it's not a lifestyle that people really, really want to be a part of. It really is something that just happens. So you're seeing this in San Diego. You're seeing the rise in homelessness in places like New York. Even my hometown of North Carolina, I live in Knightdale, which is a suburb outside of Raleigh, North Carolina. And I see more and more people holding signs for money for assistance, for financial assistance, because this is a very, very real problem. And let's be frank, everyone, we're all a week or two or a moment or a second from homelessness. So what you're saying, although it's striking, it is a reality, and I think it's something that we'll see more of.
And you're accurate. I was reading several articles this week preparing for this show, and one of the articles speak exactly of what you just mentioned. There was a gentleman who was a professional, made over $100,000 a year as a result of the pandemic, you know, was forced to go to retirement, but he said for him, in fact, there was no retirement, so it needed very much his income. And he was living off of his 401k plan, his savings plan, that was about to deplete. And the author of the article was, you know, giving him some advice on some programs and trying to reach out to ahead of time before he did become homeless.
Right.
And those lines are so long. The wait is so long, you know, people are facing this moratorium, this renter's moratorium that's about to end June 30th. Now, some states, because now they're doing it, they're doing making extensions on a federal level. Many states are trying to get extensions on the state level. The moratorium prevented landlords from evicting tenants who could not pay their rent as a result of the pandemic. So the policy switched, in a sense, initially, any renter who was suffering as a result of the pandemic could file for a declaration. But however, that changed. So renters then had to become in need. So all of those initial applications became invalid, okay? According to a 35-page filing of a particular group that was requesting a moratorium extension because the burden shifted from the nation's 30 to 40 million renters to its 10 to 11 million landlords, most of whom own small businesses. Landlords, as a result of this shift, lost approximately $13 billion. Now, here's a note of fact. That $13 billion hasn't gone anywhere. It hasn't gone to the renters. It hasn't gone to the landlords. But the money is allocated. So the funds aren't being processed. So next week, we're going to see what this looks like. So you are exactly right in that millions of people are at the door of homelessness. Many of those people have extended places to go or families to help. So we're going to see a different format in less than a week. $13 billion. So, yes. So we look at, exactly. So we look at this family, and this is America, one of the most so-called powerful countries in the world. And we're looking at third world in this country. You know, we talk about the infrastructure of the family. Let's talk about that for a few minutes, Dr. Muhammad. We just had Mother's Day celebrated for Father's Day last week. Happy Father's Day to all those fathers who are involved in their family's life, their children, and their well-being. We had a day modified for Mother's Day to celebrate, but truly, every day is Mother's Day and Father's Day. So we're going to talk about the infrastructure of the family. There was a gentleman, I read an article, and it was so touching. And he said, he was working in the healthcare field, and he said, I have opted not to take the vaccine. He said, because my children need me.
Mm-hmm.
And we discussed this on this show, that's a personal choice, and he reviewed factors, and he decided not to do it. And he and his wife supported one another, and he said he would stay home with the children and the wife would continue to work. She was not in the healthcare field, and she was able to work remotely. And he said that they had to tighten up on food, whatever they had to do, they were going to do it because his family needed him. And I thought that was so admirable, of someone giving consciousness to create a plan that was going to work for them. So let's talk, Dr. Muhammad, a few minutes about the infrastructure of family life and how important that is during these times.
Me, like you, I think family is very, very, very important, especially during these times. But you really can't talk about family without talking about how the family was torn down in the black community among black people from the inception of slavery and up until now. And so there's a lot of work that needs to be done in our communities because, you know, we still don't know who we are as a people. We're here in the United States. We still see the ravaged demons of our black men on a daily basis. Our women are just sporting themselves on Instagram and Facebook, and they continue to be naked and don't know their worth and understand who they are as women, and that this nation, any nation, is, you know, is judged by the standard of women. And I think when we're out of that, then we really can't produce a family that's going to be fruitful, and that will leave a generational legacy. So I think when we have to work on the inner demons of ourselves as individuals, where we come from in terms of slavery, and we've made many strides. You know, we have made many strides as a people, and, you know, we, by Allah's grace and permission, we will continue to make strides. And with Islam, we, you know, we have Allah, we have all that we need to continue to grow as a community. But we do have to make a conscious decision to want change. We do have to make a conscious decision to want to better ourselves and our lives. And I think, you know, that, you know, there's a saying, I know we've all heard this before, that, you know, money is the root of all evil. That's been embedded in our society. And so when you think about money and greed and lust, sometimes that takes precedence over the important things. And so when you mention Father's Day, sometimes as a people, as fathers, we think being a father is providing presence instead of being present for our children. Why? It's driven by what? Greed. It's driven by things, and we think our children will love us if what we are able to do for them. And that's not what fatherhood is all about. It's about creating memories. It's about teaching, you know, your family morals and values and things of that nature. And so I think that we really have to change our frame of thought as fathers, as mothers, as community leaders, and just focus more on serving Allah first and foremost, and seek His kingdom first, and then all things will be added unto us as a family. So I just wanted to add that. Thank you for asking.
All praises are due to Allah. The actress Monique made a public Twitter statement, and I'll just paraphrase. I'm not going to quote exactly what she said, but I'll paraphrase what she challenged, and I thought it was so interesting. And what she tweeted about was her experience of going out to public places, supermarkets, retail stores of any kind, appointments, whatever it may be. And she spoke specifically to the African American female community. Mm-hmm. And her concern or her consciousness brought her to comment on the appearance. She said, what is going on? And she referred to the community as queens and kings. And she said, the queens, what, you're coming out of the house with your pajamas on. You're wearing, you know,
bandana
hair.
Such. At the airport. At the airport, I did. She mentioned the airport. We have lost our identity. Exactly. We do not know who we are. You're not putting your clothes on now. You have no right. Why? And we are queens and kings. What are you doing? People who responded, you know.
What?
No, she brought up a very conscious problem here. Right. Monique, that's the name that she goes by, right? That is the name
Monique.
That she goes by, yes. And she was harassed for making those truthful comments.
She was harassed.
Denigrated and disrespected. For being conscious. Now, you know, we're in a society where, you know, when you're being denigrated and put down and let down because you're speaking truth. And so that just goes to show you the mindset that we're in as a people and as women in general. And so I found that to be very interesting that you brought that up, because I read about some of the reactions that she was getting from people, and they were very angry with her. They were very uptight. She received a lot of backlash for that.
upset. They were upset. And I thought she brought up a very valid point. So it's a fortunate point of saying, you know, if you are my grandmother, Sister May, you know, my mother, Hadir Elami Muhammad, Sister Al-Zoex, who's in the nation, our father, Abdur Muhammad, is in the nation, Robert Jevonex, but also our grandmother, who lived to be 93 years old, Sister Halima, and she was Sister May. And she used to always say, how do you say you're of God if you don't try to look like God? But she didn't mean that on a physical level. She was talking about behavior, outside appearance. What are your daily acts? You're being represented even if you're not being physically, you don't see a God. You should be able to feel that God's presence in your daily life. And she was adamant about, one of my inspirations is reading Quran every day. And Sister May used to read her scriptures every day, sometimes more than once a day. And she said, this is my spiritual meal. Her spiritual meal. Don't you recall that, Dr. Muhammad?
I certainly do. I certainly do. So that's why I had mentioned earlier that every nation is judged by the standard of women. When you have women who are demoralized and who do not think too much of themselves, then what does that nation look like? Not very good. And that's been the order of the day. In Europe, in the U.S., we look as if we're living in a civilized society. And so we need to do better. We need to do better as women. We need to do better as mothers. We need to do better as friends. And we need to uphold who we are as a people, and that's dignified kings and queens. So it's a very important topic. And I think it's something that we should continue to strive to be better each and every day in our daily lives, be better in general for the sake of being better, not because somebody's going to get you for being better. It's for the sake of being better.
Mm. I think our brother, may Allah be pleased with him, El-Hajj, Malik El-Shabazz, Malcolm X, and again, paraphrasing, noted that very, very existence as he was speaking to international communities, you're only as strong as your women are.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a very, very important acknowledgement.
Yes, it's very important. I'll just add, as women, because I would like to tie this a little bit into Father's Day, because sometimes as women we get frustrated with our men, and we are frustrated, we're upset, but as a woman, being a single woman, it's important to try to do your best to raise your sons in a dignified manner, because one day your son is going to become somebody's wife. One day your son is going to become somebody's father. So if you're complaining about your husband, your brother, your cousin, who are male, it really stems from the upbringing of the mother. So if the mother is in the proper mindset, then she will bring up upstanding men in society to know who they are and to be prideful of who they are so they can raise a more decent society. So, you know, charity starts at home and then it's spread abroad. And that's not monetarily they're speaking about. We're talking about spiritually, emotionally. So it starts in the home. You want a better husband? Raise better son. And that's very, very important. So I just wanted to add that comment as well. I'm not being judgmental. I'm not judging for Saturday. It's very important. We have to start doing better in the home if we want to see a better society.
You're welcome. And starting better in the home. In a few weeks, we're going to have a husband and wife team on the show. And because one of my passions is to keep educating our children. As we educate our children, you know, we had Brother Ibrahim Sharif on last week, and he was dynamic. And speaking of those programs that have been offered by various corporations, folks specifically of Merck Company Incorporated and their contribution, and Dr. Kivoy Vagelos, and some of the monies that have been extended to young scholars, their education is real key. We're going to have a husband and wife team on. They've been in the tutoring business for over 20 years, ensuring that our students understand the foundation. I want to speak about my brother for a minute. I'm not going to mention his name because I didn't speak to him prior, but I am going to speak about something he did and posted to Facebook. This is my youngest brother, and I was so touched. I must mention this. And his son was graduating high school, and there was bad weather in the state in which he resided. He had to travel by plane, so he had a plane ticket to travel to see his son's graduation. And the airline canceled the flight due to the weather. And he decided to get a Greyhound bus to go to the son's graduation. And he arrived, and he was able to attend. And I was so elated. But my husband woke me up about 1 o'clock in the morning. This is the day after the graduation, because he's looking at Facebook, so forth and so on. And I said, "Why are you up? You're supposed to be asleep, get some rest before you go to work." He says, "I'm sorry. Because I have to tell you about my brother made on Facebook." And as a man, he talked about his mistakes in life and how errant of his children and this one particular son to keep striving for education when he wasn't there most of his life to guide his life. And he thanked his son on the day of graduation for being able to do this without him. And that just touched my soul. Dr. Muhammad, you mentioned it's not about gifting materialistic to our children. But it's about our presence. And I thank you for that commentary. And I just wanted to speak about that particular example. And talk about the mother that birthed this young man for a few minutes, because she was a community advocate. And she completed public service throughout her entire life. And one of the things she did before she retired, Dr. Mahalo, because you were physically there, was the food pantry. And that was featured in local newspaper articles. And she was appointed executive director in the Office on Aging, so she would service the population's aging on a daily basis. And one of the things she created was the food pantry, and you were physically there during that time. How exciting was that, Dr. Muhammad, when she was able to launch that food pantry?
Yeah, I think it was a very, very good time. It really hit home for me because he had a woman who basically started off with nothing. She started off with very humble beginnings. And actually, she was a woman, and I'm not, you know, this is not to be disparaging or anything like that, but we, you know, had to at one point call on for some governmental assistance, food stamps, and governmental assistance to get us from day to day. And to watch a woman evolve from being a welfare recipient to a welfare director and being able to find it in her heart to give to her community without that bitterness and resentment, it really did come full circle for me. You know, her trials and tribulations was just a testament to who she was as an individual. And so to see that, and for, to see her rise from her humble beginnings and basically from her ashes, it really was quite rewarding, and it really instilled a sense of pride in myself to carry on her legacy in some form or fashion in terms of community activism and just being able to send a kind word or gentle word and just being there for someone else in their time of assistance. And so that was the inspiration for me to move forward and continue to be at the forefront and in the trenches of community activism. But that's my insight on that.
Her proclivity to community service really inspired all of us, all of her children. And I remember starting my daughter off very, very young. And this was through my sister, Fatima. She would be involved in different organizations where she would take food, and she would always invite us, you know, I'm working with this particular organization. And there's one particular organization, and this is well over 20 years ago, my daughter was about 3 or 4 years old, the homeless shelter for women. And this particular homeless shelter would house women. We would donate clothes to the shelter so that women would have attire to go on interviews. So this particular shelter, and I had a realization, my cousin resided in Houston, Texas, and I remember calling him because he would speak about community issues. And we were speaking about the war on poverty specifically. The war on poverty pertains to generational poverty. So you mentioned our mother, Dr. Muhammad, and that she was able to rise from humble beginnings. And I'll tell the audience now, it's through life experience and education, yes, that propelled her to an officer of the community. So I had this awareness, and I was, my undergraduate program was completed, and I was contemplating starting my doctorate program, of which I eventually started. And I observed this one woman. She was very young. She was 25 and she had 8 children. And the state had taken away the other children, so she had one little boy with her. And he had psoriasis in his head, and he was scratching profusely. And the mother was trying to help him stay calm while she received some instructions that she needed. And my daughter at the time was 3 or 4 years old, and she looked up at me and she said, 3 or 4 years old, she could speak, and she said, "Mommy, we need to help him." Intuitively, she knew that this little boy, who was just a tad bit taller than her, needed help. So it bothered her and it bothered me, so I went and spoke to the administrators. And it became more to me than just delivering clothes for an interview, because how could she interview and her state of mind wasn't advanced to the point where she can take care of herself and her child? So I went to the administrator and I said, "Well, what exactly are you all doing here?" And then they had an affinity to my daughter because she was so happy and elated and she wasn't suffering from any ailments. And so she said, "Come with me." And she took me on a tour. And this was in the heart of Atlanta. And she took me on a tour and she showed me the shelter areas. She showed me the cafeteria. She showed me "Good morning and welcome to Family Life. Your host, Salima Muhammad, and Dr. Nadia Muhammad. Dr. Muhammad will be on later this month. This program is sponsored by New Africa Excellence, the Rod Speaks. Bismillah, and Muhammad Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most gracious and most merciful. I greet my guests and the listening audience. Assalamu alaikum. This week's discussion on family life, we have a distinguished and honored guest, a retired FBI agent, Mr. Warren Flagg. We also have a community activist who happens to be my niece, Ms. Shauna Tarboro. And we welcome them both. Mr. Flagg, born in Yonkers, New York.
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm going to go ahead and let the audience know a little bit of your background first, and then we'll go right into discussion. Mr. Flagg, thank you. Mr. Flagg, born in Yonkers, New York, educated at the University undergraduate degree, Bachelor of Science, University of Arizona. He then went on to become a Federal Bureau of Investigation agent out of Washington, D.C. He's been assigned several significant cases during his tenure, including the FBI NYO Criminal Division, Queens Department of Motor Vehicle. And we're going to discuss this in detail, Mr. Flagg. I'm just going to give the audience a foundation. Don King Insurance, thank you. Don King Insurance Fraud Cases. He is the president and founder of Flagman Incorporated, a private investigative firm located in New York City. He has 3 retired FBI agents with extensive experience. Mr. Flagg was awarded the FBI Volunteer of the Year Award for 1996, 1997, and 1998 for his work with Pier 72 in Harlem, New York. Since leaving the FBI, Flagg has worked in the television as a technical consultant on Fox News and a technical advisor on the movie After the Sunset with Woody Harrelson and Selma Hayek. In addition, Mr. Flagg was technical advisor to the Emmy-nominated Showtime original series, Sleepless Cell, American Terror, starring Michael Ealy and Odette Farrar. For the past 6 years, the Flagg has sponsored a number of British police officers who actually come every September 11th in honor of our fallen heroes, as well as the 67 British citizens who died as a result of the 9/11 attacks. We also have Ms. Shauna Tarborough, and she is a community activist here in Arizona, working specifically on community grant projects, Arizona Fair Housing Partnerships. We'll talk to her, as well as Flagg. To the both of you, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. I didn't know it did that much.
I was taking notes.
So was I.
Let's get started.
Well, first of all, let me say this. I want to wish everybody a happy July 4th and Salaam Alaikum.
Alaikum Asalaam, and thank you so much again. Listen, let's get started. You know, this is where I want to begin. I want to really start, you know, as this program is sponsored by New Africa Excellent Mirage Speaks, let's start with the corruption of boxing. And Mr. Flagg, if you can go into detail your experience with this particular case, your experience specifically, and how you came to meet Murad Muhammad and why. Proceed.
Okay, well, I worked in the New York office from 1976, the FBI, only in the criminal division. And as a result of that, I got to know many prosecutors, some of which were then later on went to become federal judges. But there was one particular individual. Her name was Mary Jo White. Now, she was the head of the Eastern District. In New York, for your listeners, I need to explain, there are two districts. You have the Southern District in New York, which handles cases in Manhattan, Orange, Rockland, up to almost Albany. And then you have the Eastern District, which handles Brooklyn, Queens, and all the way out in Long Island. Unlike a lot of the FBI offices, we're able to work in two different districts under two different U.S. attorneys. Mary Jo White was the chief prosecutor in the Eastern District, and then became the U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York. During the course of my various investigations, Mary Jo White called me up. Now, I need to give you a protocol here. I was a street agent, always a street agent. There in New York, you have an assistant director, you have special agents in charge, they're called SACs. Then you have assistant special agents in charge. Then you have coordinators, supervisors, and agents. Seven levels, okay? But I had done so many criminal cases that Mary Jo White would handpick me and other agents because, A, we weren't afraid to do the right thing, testify, and do thorough investigations. So she called me into her office one day and said, listen, individual that you're going to meet is the accountant for Don King. His name, by the way, was Joseph Mafia. No, he wasn't a Mafia member. So we are sitting at this table, and Mr. Mafia says, listen, I have checks and information that Don King stole $21 million from Mike Tyson. And I said, well, that sounds like a good case. And Mary Jo said, listen, Warren, you're going to work with somebody from the IRS. Excellent. The IRS have investigators that go out and do what, like the FBI, and they also have regular people that don't do that. So I was working with a gentleman who is an excellent investigator. And the first thing we decided to do was to bring in Mike Tyson and see if he's willing to testify against Don. And lo and behold, we got word that he needed to go back to the hood, and he didn't want to testify. He said, I'll get it some other way. So I wasn't really interested in going further in the Don King investigation, but there was an insurance fraud in which Julio Cesar Chavez was cut. And back in the day, as we were building the case that Joseph Mafia brought in, I was doing background on boxing. And I was calling all these people, and this is how I got involved with Murad. I came to find out that Murad was the only promoter that wasn't nefarious. He wasn't paying off ratings. He wasn't being used by, you know, the promoters were using the boxers. They would give them anything, and then the next fight that they fought, Don would charge these people, so it was like usury. It was totally anti-fighter related. And obviously there are various crimes that go with that. You can't bribe the rating commission. These fighters that had no ratings would all of a sudden become the number one contender. And it was back during the group age where boxing was pretty prominent. It's now shifted a little, in my opinion, to the UFC. But you know, hopefully boxing will come back. You need a champion, and it's got more regulations. But in any event, get back. So I called Murad up, and I said, Murad, I need you to teach me more about the boxing. So he says, well, don't you want to interview me? And I go, no, I don't want to interview you. Murad couldn't figure it out why I didn't want to talk to him. I didn't want to give him what I was investigating. So he says to me, look, we go on, we indict Don. There's a hung jury. Clearly he collected from Lloyd's in London, and clearly collected from the fighter Julio Cesar Chavez. And I took Julio Cesar Chavez and met with him. Don't speak Spanish, but we had a very good connection. He was from Culiacan, Mexico, and from poverty. And he promised to come in and testify. Now Don would put out three or four contracts, and depending on how the fight would, the sale of the fight would happen, he'd switch the contracts. I'm going to pay you $3 million in this one, $2 million in that one, or $1 million in that. And what would end up is that Julio wouldn't make enough money to pay off his prior fight's debt, training fees, all these other things that they would escalate. Plus, as being an international fighter, a lot of times they didn't pay the IRS. Now, that's been corrected in years. But in Murad and I, later on, fast forward a little bit, actually represented Roy Jones Jr. and Manny Pacquiao, two very famous, very famous fighters. And I was the one, laugh for your listeners. I want to call at times I was the token white guy, and at times I was executive vice president at M&M Sports. It didn't make any difference. Murad would say, they're not going to let us fight in Louisiana. Warren, you got to go down there and, you know, I don't care, bring a couple other agents. You got to take the test. Because we'd all over. We would fly all over, and I would do whatever was necessary. If it was Nevada State Athletic Commission, pay, you know, bring the checks to the fighters, make sure they get paid, get their physicals into the State Athletic Commission, whatever was necessary. And we flew, you know, basically in wherever Roy wanted to fight or wherever Manny fought, and most of that was in Las Vegas. So we got to know a lot of people, and that's sort of how I got introduced to Murad. But it was funny because he had a right-hand man named Ronald Salah-Odin, at the end of this case, he tells Ron to go call Warren Flagg. So, Ron says, you're not going to get him. He's an ex-FBI agent. He's been decorated. He's been doing all this stuff. And then he called me up and I said, Ron, you're the only promoter that never stole anything from a fighter. Of course I work with you. By the way, for your listeners, I never had a contract with these people.
Oh,
I just did it. And whatever Murad thought I was worth, he paid me.
Outstanding.
There are so many crazy stories. Here's one. He and Ronald Salah-Odin were trying to get Mike Tyson back in the ring. And he calls me up. It's a Sunday night, and he said, Warren, listen, you got to fly down at 6 a.m. Manny Pacquiao's going to fight Marco Antonio Barrera in Houston, Texas, and we have nobody for M&M Sports, and you're going to be on the dais, and you're going to talk. I go, okay. So I get in the plane. I fly down. I meet Marco Antonio Barrera was represented by, very, very large boxing firm. And I'm at the dais, and I said, well, listen, we're going to shock the world here. You would have thought I had committed a crime. It was national TV on this. And so Murad flies in the night of the fight, and sure enough, Manny, they threw in the towel, and he beat Barrera, and that was sort of the beginning of our relationship with Manny Pacquiao and his entourage from the Philippines. And to this day, every time I see Manny Pacquiao, I get him to sign a glove and give it to the Philippine community in Brooklyn, New York. He is a state senator and pretty much might be the president of the Philippines soon. But boxing itself was 100% corrupt in the fact that it was allowed. People weren't really focusing in on the crime. They were more interested in who's going to fight who. They were more interested in the promotion end of it.
Mm-hmm.
Don King, how many people have committed two murders and have met every president in the United States? I mean, for the last 8 or 9. It's amazing. We've had a lot of fun. The trials were crazy. I got along better with Don's defense attorney than I did with the prosecutors. And it's kind of funny stuff. I mean, I could go into the trial. I mean, Isidore Bolton would always elbow me. He was trying to intimidate me, and one day I said to Don, call your bodyguard off. And he says, well, you can't take it. I said, no, I just want to know what the lay of the land is. I mean, it was that kind of way, you know. So the second trial, I realized that he had to pay Al Sharpton, Mayor Dinkins, and two rabbis $100,000 each. So when I came into the courtroom, it was packed, I yelled out, Al, did you get your $100,000 check? Mayor Dinkins, did you get your $100,000 check? Rabbi Levy, you get your $100,000 check? Everybody was, you know, these guys wanted to crawl into this. So then I go into the area, and it's the first time I ever saw Henrietta King, his wife. So because we got along so well, I go over, I give her a big hug, and I go, Henrietta, you and I are the only two that hope he goes to jail.
You're right. Oh, my goodness. Boy, she's
funny. No, it's, you know, to this day, Don was born in August, and his defense attorneys are kind enough to give me a cell phone, and I call him and wish him a happy birthday. So as Murad would say, we might have lost the battle. Everything is a hung jury. But we won the war because he hasn't promoted anybody since then. It cost him a lot of money. And
that's right.
He knows what he did. And it's one of the things I'm most proud of is that the people that I arrested, what is lost in today, in my opinion, is that people go, they don't confess. They lie the first time they meet an FBI agent because they're embarrassed. No one confesses the first time. And instead, since 9/11, if you lie to a federal officer, you get arrested for that. I mean, Don King was the best liar on the planet. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not right to, you know, just because he doesn't want to tell you the nuts and bolts, that he gets arrested for something that he's being questioned about. It's sad. And that all started with, you know, the terrorist side of the house, and now it's come the flavor of the month for the federal agents.
Well, you said something.
So I think it's wrong.
Listen, I read articles on Manny Pacquiao. Why did they say Murad steal from him? Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, sure. It was Freddie Pachenko, I think, who went on HBO, and for some reason, Manny's trainer, and his name slips me right now, but it's not important. He was interviewed by Manny Pacquiao, and he said, this is Murad Muhammad stolen money from Manny Pacquiao. I went to Murad's, heard it, you know, from the videotape, and I went to his suite, and I said, Murad, you have to get on, and you have to talk about this. I personally paid these guys. You should put me on, and I will testify, okay? Everybody knew me. The Nevada State Athletic Commission knew me, okay? I said, you need to put me on there to stop this rumor. I personally hand them the check, and there is a Nevada State Athletic Commission person. Not only do they sign the wrapping of the gloves, but they also cut them off. And I'm in the shower making sure that when they're doing the drug test, it's not corrupt. So the fact that I can't think of the trainer's name, in any event, it's not important. When he went on national TV and said, Murad stole, I know how much I paid him. I know how much he signed for. And so does the Nevada State Athletic Commission know that. So I said, Murad, put me on. I will refute this, kill this instantaneously. But Murad was like, no, that guy, no, he just didn't do it. But I can assure you that whatever dime owed Manny Pacquiao, I gave him the check. I still see Manny Pacquiao. He doesn't get along with his trainer anymore. So it was absolutely false. But Murad was not one to fight public opinion or negative press. He needed to stop that ASAP, but obviously, you know, I wasn't high enough in the M&M sports world to influence that. I would have personally gone, but, you know, Murad told me not to, and I said, fine, we'll go to the next fight.
So Freddie Roach, was he the trainer?
Freddie Roach, yes, that's
Freddie Roach.
Exactly.
Uh-huh. Freddie Roach, yes.
Very and you know, I just recently saw the dynamic because we are allowed to represent a fighter. The rules changed post my leaving the FBI, in which you can only get you couldn't do what Don King and Bob Arum did. You can't have a life agreement with a particular fighter. So you're allowed to have 3 years, they fight, and then there's then people bid for the, you know, if the guy's a good fighter, they bid. And that's what happened with Bob Arum. He took over Manny Pacquiao. But that kind of stuff was a reform. Now they also, the checks that I would give out, getting back in the business, the first check that goes out is to the IRS.
Mm-hmm.
The IRS was chasing around. Now they have it where you pay the IRS, I don't care what country you're from, and then you later on file your own taxes concerning your, you know, your fees of flying in and your training fees and that kind of stuff. So,
yeah. Very important work done during that historical time to change the
perspective
of the corruption of boxing during that era.
Well, and after I retired, I had actually started the investigation into, I can't remember the gentleman's name. He was in the commission in New Jersey. I don't know which commission it was, but there was a huge investigation. And I'll never forget this. I get a call from a guy named Don King. Now, I got a lot of prank calls. Guys would call up and say, Flagman, let's go. You and I settle this. We don't need another trial. This is Don King. You go, we'll fight it out ourselves. You meet me downstairs. And I go, yeah, okay. What agency are you calling from? What friend of you am I? But in any event, I literally got a call from Don. And he said, listen, the FBI is raiding my place. I need to hire you. And I said, jokingly, I said, Don, can you meet me downstairs with $250,000? And he goes, that can happen, my man.
Oh, my goodness.
So I said, obviously, I started this investigation. I can't work for you. But I got a true call from him.
The HBO host, Larry Merchant.
Yeah, Larry Merchant. That was the guy that interviewed. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm having a senile moment in my early age.
You're fine. I want to switch the subject because this is very, very interesting, and I want to know a little of what's been on with this particular case, the TWA Flight 800.
Okay. You're going to love this, okay? I hope your listeners, I turn up the volume on this, okay? Because this is, I'm telling you, Jim Kalstrom was the head of the New York FBI, and he says to me, Flagman, they call me Flagman in the FBI. And the reason they did that is back when I first joined in 1976, you couldn't say this is Agent Flag over the radios because the wise guys were stealing our radios. So you remember Top Gun where they had Iceman and I go, my last name is Flag, so I'm going to be the Flag. And I think there are guys in the FBI that don't know my real name. But in any event, so Jim Kalson called me up and he says, Flagman, do you want to work the missile theory? And I go, no, I'm going to retire. That was 1996. There was an Olympic. The Olympics were coming on in July. And this was early in July. PWA Flight 800 had been delayed at Kennedy Airport. It was extremely hot, and this was an older 747 plane. Now, it took off, and as it was going from 9,000 to 15,000 feet, something happened. A catastrophic event happened. So Jim says to me, listen, you're going to leave. I want you to go out there and find out if the Navy shot the plane down. And I said, Jim, what do you want me to do, interview them all? He goes, I'm just kidding. And get out there and find out if they shot the plane down. I said, okay. So now, I can't tell anybody, see? So I hop on this police boat from Nassau, and that particular time, they had brought up a brand-new ship called the USS Oak Hill. This was what is known as a wet vehicle. It means that it sinks, and there are things that come out of the belly of the ship and float, and it's for the Marines when they're going to land. The landing crafts go into this bay. But they put these two, call them LSDs for your listeners, but they were called Mike boats. And it's basically a flat-bottom boat, and they put two of them in the hull. And every day they would sink it, and the two Mike boats would tie up along the USS Oak Hill. And then at the end of the day, we'd go around and pick up the bodies. The agents were assigned to the two recovery crafts. One was the USS Oak Hill. The other was the USS Graff. So my job was to be on the USS Oak Hill and determine if the Navy shot the plane down. Now, in the beginning, when I got on the boat, I was met by a Marine with an M16, and he said to me, why are you here? And I said, I have no idea. I lied a little bit, okay? And he said, well, you can't go anywhere on this ship without a Marine. And I go, okay. And so for about 2 weeks, every shower, everywhere I went, every time I ate, there was a Marine with an M16 with me. So I would go from the Oak Hill over to the grass and grapple and sign, because at the time there was a possibility that this was a terrorist act. So therefore, we had to do the coordinates. Everything had to be signed by me, taking it from the agent that was on the grass, on the grapple, and then go into Mauritius and sign it to another agent that would take the remains of these people to the morgue. And they were supposed to be identified, and the family members were then to be called. Well, I found out pretty early that our secret FBI phone was being co-opted. And because we were 11 miles off the coast of Long Island, it would take an hour and 15 minutes to get to Mauritius, even though I had all the personal effects from each individual that was recovered that particular day, and would then give that to the agent that met me at Mauritius. The people, somebody was monitoring our secret phone, and the pictures of the people and the bodies that were recovered were on the CNN and the newspapers before I even got there. And it was very, very disconcerting for the family members, obviously. And secondly, you know, this might have been a crime, and somebody's hacking our phone. So I started taking walk around. It would take a while, and I'd walk around and see what was going on. There were a lot of activity in Mauritius. They built a landing pad there for helicopters. They were giving out these cell phones. So he said, why are you giving me a cell phone? He said, well, call anybody. I know this is traumatic for you. So I said, yeah, give me one. So I take the cell phone and give it to the divers. Now, the Navy divers were on the USS Oak Hill. There were 180 divers.
Oh.
And they were attached. There were two groups on the fan tails of the grasp and the grapple. So that's four different groups. They had oxygen, helium, and nitrogen, and they would unwind these mixture as the divers would go down into the wreckage at 180 to 210 feet. Now, these divers were spectacular. They worked 12-hour shifts. So 90 people worked a 12-hour shift and another 90, and they would come back to the USS Oakdale where I was. And this went on day after day, obviously weather permitting. One of the things that was very, very troubling to me is that they could not put the recovery of these people into the plastic bags under the water. The viscosity was too much, so they would hold on to these people that they recovered for 40 minutes at 80 feet to 100 feet. And then the FBI agent, along with the ERT, which is the evidence retrieval team, would help put them in the proper perspective and secure any their personal belongings. And then I would come around, and we would load them into the Mike boat and take them into this. And this went on till we recovered all 243 people.
And you were on the scene. Oh, my goodness. On the scene.
Now,
listen, initially, I just want to mention this a quick minute. The NTSB is notified, but they cannot investigate criminal investigation, which is why the feds are called in, correct?
Yeah, and we also thought, okay, let's give you a little background. That day that the plane went down was the day that Ramzi Youssef, who was the original bomber in 1993, of the World Trade Center. Didn't bring it down, but he killed eight people.
Remember that, yes.
He was sentenced that day. So we thought that Al-Qaeda, the FBI, that Al-Qaeda was going to shoot a plane down just because of the sentencing. In any event, I and other people, it was an amazing event for the Navy's salvage guys. They never complained, and as I was taking these cell phones and giving it to them, I could see that they wanted to talk to their loved ones. I mean, I would love somebody to do a trauma effect of the people, these young 18 to 22-year-old divers, and how the effect of holding these deceased individuals that crashed, how they're doing today. I stay in touch with three or four of them. But anyway, get back to the story. I knew that I needed to get into some of the special areas in the ship to find out if the Navy shot the plane down. So when I would spend 3 weeks on the Oakdale and 1 week off. And when I was off, I'd get popcorn and whatever the heck they needed. Utter bomb for their legs, their hands, their feet and hands were cracking, and anything they needed. These divers, I would go out of my way to do anything. My daughters cooked cookies for them. These guys were just spectacular. So you remember I told you that they hacked our phones, so I called the head of the operation in the command center at Mauritius. Kenny is a friend of mine, and I said, listen, you got to get me a secret phone here. This is ridiculous. So they bring out a secret cell phone, which you hit one, you push the button one, two, and three, and then it hits three satellites, and you can talk, and we were able to stop the hacking of the bodies and the people that were being brought up. So there were times when it would rain and the poor divers couldn't dive. They had a four-point mooring, and I know this is a little too much for your listeners, but you could imagine any downtime for these guys was too much. So I said to Kenny, the FBI supervisor, I said, look, do me a favor. Let's put telephones on each of the ships and let them call home. Let them talk. these guys need to get everybody, need to pick up the wreckage, need to do all this diving for us, and we need to give them an out. They don't want to talk to priests. They don't want to talk to rabbis. They don't even want to talk to me. They want to talk to their family members.
Mm-hmm.
And so they did. And I said, this is a dual purpose. We can listen to their conversation. And what I had learned over the 4 or 5 weeks that I was out there is that every time a missile in the Navy was moved, a guy signed for it, they videotaped the launching, and they account for it on a monthly basis because it's so expensive, and they're 18 to 20-year-olds that are running the stuff. And they have one, you know, one master sergeant that's a little old, maybe he's 27. So here's this FBI agent, I'm learning all this, and I said, well, look, we'll monitor the phones, and obviously if somebody's selling the videotape, then we know that the Navy shot it down. So they agreed to that, and we monitored those calls, and these guys loved it. And I would bring out popcorn, and finally I got into this area, you know, where, it's like TV, where it's got every ship in the Navy across the screen. And so I said, well, what's that ship? He said, that's the USS John F. Kennedy. And I said, where is it? And he said, well, you can see he's in the Gulf Coast there. I said, well, how do you talk to that? He said, oh, pick that phone up. And then a little red dot goes on there, and this is Commander Flagg. And some 18-year-old guy came up, and I said, sailor, I need the centigrade and Fahrenheit immediately, and I wanted fax to the USS Alco. Do you understand? I didn't know the commander was pretty high up. Anyway, zing over this machine, fax would come this, you know, it was 102 and 36 centigrade, whatever. So I said, that's amazing. So they'd sit in there, give them popcorn, and leave. So what happens is, as I'm going around picking up the various recovery of the victims, and I was talking to the divers when they were off, they said, well, I said, what do you guys need? And they said, well, we're getting sick. Our foul weather gear is destroyed. I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, it never dries. We have dryers on all three ships, but there's 180 divers, and there are guys that have to put on wet foul weather gear. And, you know, we're getting colds, we're getting sick, and we just want to get going. I said, well, won't the Navy send up more dry foul weather gear? He goes, no, all we're doing is, you know, they're flying off and getting food for all three vessels, and they're constantly going back and forth to Mauritius and picking up the food. In any event, I said, okay, so I pick up this secret cell phone, and I talk to somebody, obviously in Washington, D.C., and I said, you got to call LLB. And so she said, well, I just said, just put me through to LLB. And evidently, she must have identified where I was and what happened, and all of a sudden, the phone and the gentleman on the other end goes, how can I help you? And I said, well, I'm out in the middle. You know, he goes, how can I help you? I know where you are. I said, well, we need some foul weather gear. And he said, well, how many divers you have? I said, 180. He said, can you fly up tomorrow and pick up 300 sets of foul weather gear? So I said, yeah. Now, first of all, I didn't ask Commander Durden, who was the head of the hotel, nor did I say to any of the flight guys. They would fly me off, see, because I was bringing all this swag back every time I got off the plane. And so when we get in the plane, they think they're flying me off. And I said, listen, we're going to Portland Bay. And the guy goes, I can't do that. And I said, we're going. So we fly to Portland, Maine. We pick up 300 sets of foul weather gear. And when I'm there, I said to the people, I said, you know, and he had a couple of basketball courts. These guys need there's a lot of downtime, and it's July. They put two basketball courts in there. Now, I tell you this story.
I'm standing.
2011. I had a bag, and I sent it to LLB, and they sent me one back no charge. And I sat down and wrote a two-page letter to the owner, Leon Gorman, A week later, he wrote me back and thanked me for what he did. He never billed the government. And he said, I was part of the Cuban Missile Crisis, and that's the reason why I gave this to the Navy. So, needless to say, I basically owned the ship after I gave out all these. I'd fly off, and I said, every day they would come and have a different meeting or something, you know, and trying to find out where the wreckage is and stuff, and I'm still on there. And I said, well, why are you guys ringing 2 bells and announcing? He said, well, Admiral so-and-so's coming, Commander so-and-so's coming. He said, look, when I land on the Oak Hill, I want 5 bells and I want to be announced. Oh, they did.
Wow.
Oh, it's crazy. But it, long story, at the end of this, I actually, part of the amazing thing, these divers were so appreciative. And he said, well, what do we do with these? I said, just take them. You go home. You know, nobody knows. But I had an FBI hat. And I was constantly trying to keep their spirits up. So I would make calls to McDonald's and say, look, I need all your hamburgers you're about to throw out. And I would call every McDonald's in Long Island and fly in and get them. And even these were, some of them had green mold on them, but they didn't care. They would cut the mold off. These guys were starving. So then I started ordering up, you know, washers and dryers for the guys. I mean, I just using the phone just to keep doing different things. So it was right during the election, and I said to a lot of the divers, they were hanging around on the top of the Oak Hill in the Crow's Nest area where I hung out, and they would say, listen, can't get the Olympics because the radar was on the ship was interfering. So I said, well, how do we get by that? So I called up somebody. We flew them out. He fixed it so they could watch the Olympics. And I said, if you remember, Richard Jewell was, there's a movie about him. He was actually, should have been a hero. The FBI tortured him. So he was part of the bombing of the 96 Olympics. So I say to about 20 guys that are standing around, let's see how secret this cell phone is. And they go, what do you mean? What are you going to do? And I said, I'm going to call down to the 800 number, and I'm going to say I'm Richard Jewell. They go, you're not going to do that. I said, well, let's find out if they ever find out where to phone it. So I call up the 800 number, and I said, this is Richard Jewell. I didn't bomb that thing. I'm innocent. And I hung up. 3 days later, the guys on the radar call me and said, Mr. Flagg, we got over the radio that they're coming to get you to arrest the guy that was fooling around. We're going to put you in an air conditioning unit. So the Marines stuck me in an air conditioning unit. Then these guys came out to arrest me. They said, where's that FBI agent that called? I said, no, there hasn't been anybody here in a week.
Oh, my goodness. Richard Jewell that was out of
Atlanta
in 1990.
Yes, Richard Jewell, exactly. I was 100% right. Come on. But
you were. Now listen.
What was interesting? Now, I stayed after the recovery of all the victims, and they were looking for the fourth engine because they thought the missile would be it. Okay, so
that's
now.
That's where I was going.
All right, hang on. I got all this. Okay. So what happens is, call us up. It's in the middle of the night, and the divers have found the fourth engine, and it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and they sink the USS Oak Hill, and we hop on. Now we're going to take the engine, and I motor over to the grass, and who's there but Tom Barden, another agent, and he says, Warren, can I ride with you into Mauritius? We had to go another 8 miles because of the weight of the engine, and they could get a crane close enough to the water to lift it. And I said, well, it's raining. You're certainly welcome. There's no place to hide. I mean, we're going to be soaked. You know, hopefully you have your LL Bean wet gear. So, Tom and I take a ride in, and we walk around. And I so happened to have FBI hat that had an Olympic pin on it, had an Oak Hill pin on it, had a grass pin on it, and some other pins. And as we're coming out of the Maritz's, the hat literally gets blown off my head because it was pouring rain. And it goes into the water. And Tom says to the Navy guy, turn it around. You got to get that hat. That hat's important. And I could see the shore. I said, well, it'll wash up on shore. Well, lo and behold, 3 days later, I get a call on our secret cell phone. I have to answer it. Tom says the hat traveled 12 miles and the divers picked it up. And I go, ah, no way. I said, I'm coming over there. This hat flew between. I don't know how it did. It floated 12 miles out. I mean, these ships are 200 feet. Out of all the places this hat could have gone, I still have the hat. It's amazing. And these divers came up to my retirement.
Wow.
The fourth engine was not, obviously they investigated it. And then later on, I actually went on the scallop boats. And we scraped the bottom of the sound looking for, obviously, remains, looking for items of, you know, that were blown away by, that were due to passengers. One was reported was an engagement ring that we returned. And we were looking for the pump. Now, get back to the, you know, I'm in this secret area I shouldn't be in, okay? And I see this on the screen. It's a blip that goes over. And I go, what the heck is that, guys? And he says, well, that's the Russian satellite. They should go on out and take a look. Have you noticed during the night that these satellites are going? And I said, they're taking pictures of our recovery here? And he goes, oh, no, no, no. On the other side is the Groton, Connecticut. That's where the submarine base is. And he says, I go, do they turn those cameras off? And he says, I doubt it. That's why they take pictures. They want to know what submarine's coming, what submarine's going. So being the trained investigator and fun guy that I am, I said, well, you know, I'm going to go to the Russian embassy and I'm going to tell them that I'm the head of the New York office and I want the photographs on July 20th. I'll be back in 3 weeks, never thinking that they would give it to us. Well, they did. And I also picked up the phone from those photographs and could see what ships were in the area. So I would call them up. Ooh. It was Commander Flag. I want all you Stinger missiles. They faxed them to me. One was in Little Creek. One was out wherever the hell they were. They deployed after months. And I put them in a folder. Now November, you know, the case is over. I even had Julio Cesar Chavez. He was preparing for the second Don King trial. I took him to the USS Oak Hill, and he signed the book. It was the greatest thing I could do for those sailors.
Wow.
So, what's amazing to this whole thing is Jim Kallstrom calls me, and he says, Flagman, get up here. And I go, oh, am I going to get a medal? And he goes, no, you're not going to get a medal. Pierre Salinger, the former secretary of President Kennedy's former press secretary, has irrefutable evidence that the Navy shot the plane down. I said, I'll be up in a minute. You go, no, get up here now. I'm going on national TV. So I walk in, I give him the folder. And he goes, where the hell did you get these? I got them from the Russian embassy. And here's all the Stinger missiles. Go tell them to go to hell. Excuse my language, but that's what I said. So sure enough, 2 days later, Pierre Salinger refuted. He said, I'm awful sorry. And there, if you notice that NTSB made an enactment of what actually happened.
Yes.
Now explain to your listeners. One, the right wing was full of fuel. The left wing on this 747 was half full.
cool.
If the center fuel tank was full, you cannot stick a torch in there. It would not explode. But what happened was is that the air conditioning units, when they emptied the center fuel tank, there was residual in there. It vaporized, and the pilots thought that they were going from 9 to 15,000 feet, that it had actually cooled down enough and condensed enough that they were going to pour all of the wing fuel into the center fuel tank. And when they flipped the switch, it sparked and it blew up.
Correct.
Now, how do I know that? I walked every family member through a reconstruction of that plane.
Really?
The plane is manufactured with I-beams. There were over 800 tool marks above, below, sideways of the center fuel tank, so you could see that the explosion came from inside the tank outward.
Yes, yes. And the TVR was really the indicator that helped determine that cockpit voice recorder.
Yes.
That alarmed the pilots to those fuel indicators.
Yes. And if you noticed, there hasn't been one family member that is accused or has books written about the 50 different or 150 people that saw the fuel and saw the missile and yada, yada, yada. Not one family member. If you walk through this plane, if I took any of these people through, you would understand that it came from the center fuel tank.
Well, that's
and we had photographs of the tool mark, yeah.
That's remarkable.
So,
thank you. Thank you for your service. Thank you.
back to divers.
That's why I said those 180 and those black
yes.
men and women who participate in that process today. Thank you for your service.
Yeah.
Let's redirect. I want to, prior to going on, ladies and gentlemen, this program is brought to you by New Africa Excellent and Rod Speaks. And Shauna, I want you to jump in here. Warren Flagg. Mr. Warren Flagg.
AKA Shauna, the Flag Man.
AKA the Flag Man.
Come on, Shauna.
Warren Flagg Man. I want to direct this. You know, because we have some national issues going on now.
Yes.
And listen, let me finish before you speak. And then if Shauna has a question, let her ask it. Because I know you're going to be wired up about this. So just hold on a minute and let me get this out. All right. So let's talk about defunding the police. Don't say anything yet. Now, here's my position on this. I don't necessarily support defunding the police unless there's a problem in a problem area. However, I do think there needs to be reallocation of funds. And I stated to you earlier, I went to San Diego, and I seen, you know, Skid Row for the first time in my life. Now, I grew up in the New York metropolitan area, North New Jersey, in some of the suburbs of New Jersey. And here's the problem. There's miles and miles, and yes, it's probably exacerbated by the pandemic, but obviously there's a problem that existed before the pandemic. Miles and miles of people homeless. And I think the most shocking thing to me was that they were all ethnicities. There wasn't one specific ethnicity. Every group in ethnic history of backgrounds was represented on Skid Row. I was shocked. So then, and Shauna, you have the grant background in neighborhood community projects to assist with affordable housing. That's a whole other spectrum. Shauna, do you have a question for the side man before we go in? So I want him to elaborate on this, but before you do, Shauna, please present any questions you may have with regard to this specific subject.
With regard to defunding the police?
Yes. And affordable housing. And affordable housing. You know, what is your question to the Black man regarding affordable housing? How this all happened? What's going on? You know, in New York there's one problem, in Phoenix there's another problem. But if you have a generic question for him, please ask him now.
Okay, I've had so many questions.
Fire away.
There's a story. You know, so many questions, but to stick with, you know, the topic at hand, I think my question, I'm sure I'll have more questions as you talk, but I think my question is, what do you think of the looking at, or how important do you think looking at the training and the qualifications? Like, I thought there was a logical test. I thought there was more rigorous testing and evaluation in order to law enforcement. Can you speak on that, the training, how that impacts?
Okay. I know exactly where you're going with this, and I'm sure that I'm going to be able to answer you in a coherent fashion. Number one, if you are a local law enforcement officer, you only have to be a high school graduate. So let's just start there. If you're an FBI agent, you have to be a college graduate. Not only that, you need to go to Quantico, Virginia, and you are tested in three phases. The law, physical, and then obviously firearms training. The police academy, just to talk about the New York City police, there are 35,000 police officers, okay? There is a group of officers, it's called the Internal Affairs Division, IAD here. Now, I'm sure that every police department has an Internal Affairs Division. And what do? They investigate allegations against police officers, any allegation. In the FBI, for your information and for your listeners' information, it's called not Internal Affairs. It's a specific group run out of the Department of Justice that comes in and investigates any allegation. And what do I mean by that? Somebody, and of course, I'm one that has experienced these various investigations, because if somebody picks the phone up and says, Warren Flagg is on the take with the mob, the FBI launches an internal affairs investigation by the Department of Justice, and you're the last one to be interviewed. Mm-hmm. Now, what do? They give me a thing called an employee advice of rights. And I'm going to get back to your original question, but you need to have this background so that you know when it comes to training what happens to us. And then down, obviously, they don't have the funds that we do as an FBI agent or somebody who works in the federal government. So their training is going to be less. Their firearms training is going to be less. Their academy training is going to be shorter. Okay? They deal with immediate crime. We deal with long-term crime.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is you get an advice of rights. It's called a 695, and it's you have the right. You have to answer the questions, and if you lie, it's lack of candor, and you get fired. There's no... no ifs, ands, or buts about it. It's simple. You tell the truth. If you've done something stupid, you fall on the sword, and you might get suspended for a week if it's minor. But if you out and out lie about being corrupt, you're going to get fired. And they know the answers before they ask the question. So... to get back into here, you're even the FBI out of the 13,000 agents, and I want your listeners to understand, just because we might have 700,000 applicants
mm-hmm.
that are qualified to be, the only way you become an FBI agent is when somebody else retires and they get your cred number and your badge number. Unlike the police, who increase, you know, the FBI knows how many people are going to retire, so they have classes, and they keep the flow going and the training going. Now, I agree that there needs to be more training, but you have to understand that I'm sure that give the example of the police officer that killed Mr. Floyd. He was brought up on charges 17 times.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he was.
Who handled that internal investigation? That person or those people should be charged.
Correct. Right.
It is, when you get to a certain level, I don't care what it is, you're going to know that this guy is a racist, this guy is not good, this guy is not, should not be in the empowerment of a police officer. My opinion, obviously. The important thing here is that there is a mechanism already in place
mm-hmm.
by defunding this and not enhancing it. I have a recommendation that's going to answer your question. New York City has 35,000 cops. The problem, the appearance is that it's a long gray line, and they're not really going to look at this guy, and they're not going to dig into it. So what you do is you go over to New Jersey, and you say to the New Jersey police officers, I don't care what, you know, it could be Hoboken police, you have an IAD. You guys come into New York and you conduct the investigation, just like they do in the FBI. These people
yeah.
don't care about Warren Flag. This will give the appearance that it is an independent investigation
yeah.
done by a police officer that knows what should be asked and how to ask and what the right thing to do and what the wrong thing to do. If you get civil people or you get politicized it or you defund it, you are going to have anarchy, homelessness. I have interviewed and talked
yes.
recently yes. with people, over 800 cops have put in their papers due to the fact that the police in New York is being attacked. You don't want to. The New York City police officers are now not proactive trying to stop crime. They are reactive. They would rather show up and pick up the pieces. That's not what the police department's about. There is nothing scarier, for you guys to know this, there is nothing scarier to pull up car over, not knowing who is driving. It could be for a headlight. It could be for anything. And not know that that guy isn't a murderer in there. And most of the time, you're by yourself. And it is the scariest thing that ever happens. You pray that he's going to listen to your commands, put his hands out, not do anything stupid. I understand the body cams, but I'm trying to tell you how frightening that is. Even for me as an FBI agent, when I would go out and arrest guys at 5 a.m. in the morning, and most of the people that we arrested know we're coming. We ain't the flower man. We ain't the milkman. You knock on somebody's door at 5 a.m., they've already been arrested numerous times by the time we get them. They're bad guys. You don't know if he's going to shoot through the door or whether he's going to go easy. And there's a training involved in that. And I believe that because these guys don't have the education, mm-hmm. aren't getting enough of this training, by defunding it, yes, put more money into the training end of it, but independently take the IAD, the Internal Affairs Division, and let independent people from other police forces look at the cases. Some of them can be handled. They're allegations that are frivolous. But the ones that are serious, the ones that have been charged or been brought up on charges 17, 18 times, that needs to be done. That needs to be done by an IAD that is independent, that doesn't know the guy and doesn't care about it, just wants to know what the truth is. I hope that answered part of your question. You probably fired off more.
No, actually, I have some experience in this area. In my work, I do discrimination, and we do that through testing. And we call it fair housing law enforcement because basically we want to find people. I like to check people doing the right thing and not discriminating. And through my work over 15 years or so, I kind of got a bit of a name for myself, and the Department of Justice had called in of an investigation of the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office. I don't know if you're...
Please, of course I know that guy.
There's our bio.
Come on. You're talking to the flag man. Of course I know that guy.
Exactly. So the Melendez case. So they were required to find out if their complaint process was...
valid.
Biased or valid, right. And so I put together a training manual, and we met with the IA department, or
Internal Affairs,
IBL. Yeah. So we met with them over months, and we came up with a testing program and questions. And I did some of the tests in all of the different jurisdictions, the divisions in Maricopa County, and it was very interesting. And my testers were scared. I was scared on my first one because you're going in there and we're taping, videotaping and audio recording the deputies,
right,
to see if they're doing the right thing. And, I can't speak on
specific cases.
Right, I can't speak on the investigation, but it was very interesting because I guess I can say I found what I expected to find, in that there was a lack of uniformity.
Well, not only a lack of uniformity, these guys don't like to be snitches.
Right.
So, it takes a while to break that down to get to the real answer.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly.
And that has to be done with the help, not only yourself, who is an outstanding professional, and I'm glad you did that, but you need to have people that know how to interview people and
right.
say, wait a second, this is the right thing. Because I really believe that police officers – jail people, officers.
Mm-hmm.
They really want to do the right thing. They join not because they, want to give inmates marijuana and everything else. They really want to play by the rules. And once they know that the rules are skewed, they're afraid to change the rules.
Right.
And you know what I'm talking about.
Sure. I agree. It's that culture. And I feel like, to that point, I feel like when you said that instead of state funds and corruptions to reactive, I feel like it's been reactive for decades. my argument is that it's always been reactive. It's not, it's, you want to prevent crime, but usually you're, you know, the police are showing up after the crime has already been committed. And not only are the police fearful, but of course the citizens are too.
Well, let me interrupt there a little bit because, and I'm only going to talk about New York. I don't know how things are in Arizona. Each state is different. But if it's a serious crime, then you have a different bureau here that have got a lot of experience. Okay, the local uniformed police officer does his or her job and then turns it over to the detectives. They are the ones that come on the scene. Okay. But it's the detectives that really do the investigation. And I will tell you this, they are inundated with numerous murders in New York City, which have increased.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care. You can look at Newark. I work with Ronald Saladin. You can target areas. There are areas that shootings, drive-bys, these poor people that are getting killed for no reason, they're getting shot up, cars are being shot up.
Mm-hmm.
There is a group and an area that needs to be targeted. But that's the detectives that do that. Do you understand? People are mixing that up. They're thinking police officers all wear uniforms and they're all that. These detectives walk around. Go ahead. Refute me.
I'm not repeating it. I get what you're saying. I wasn't talking about detectives.
But I wanted the listeners to understand there's a difference.
There is a difference, absolutely.
Okay.
There is a difference. Absolutely. And I really like that you said that line about people getting killed for no reason. That's the part of defund the police. I hate that word. I hate that phrase. I think it's ridiculous because it doesn't really speak to what actually needs to be done and what people actually want to be done. I feel what is that reason? There is a reason. There is a reason. Is that reason mental health?
Yes.
Is that reason a lack of opportunity? Is that reason abuse? You know, years of abuse. Is that, you know, that's the part that I think defund the police goes to, is that more money goes into preventing, you know, helping people who have a mental health crisis, helping people who are, you know, who want to rob because they're in poverty, or people who are, you know, addicted to drugs and need, you know, substance abuse and that kind of thing. I don't think that we should get rid of the police altogether. I definitely think that money should go into proper training, proper education, that they should take their time instead of pushing people through the academy so fast. You know, really get a sense of what this career is about, what this job is about, and really coming at it from a point of service. And I'll tell you that. Most of the police officers I've worked with come from that place. They're like, you know what, we want more training in dealing with people who have mental health issues or, you know, various disabilities. We want more support. And I know
clearly.
In Phoenix they have started working with mental health counselors and things like that and getting training, but it's still not enough. They get about 3 hours. Which isn't enough.
It's not enough. And it all has to do with the almighty dollar. And it needs to be directed right.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't think we have a disagreement here.
No. I would never disagree with somebody that's more intelligent than me and also went to the same university that I did, okay?
Right. Yes.
University of Arizona.
So you see how well our training was,
yes.
Listeners.
Absolutely.
We became good citizens, like Arizona State.
And contributing citizens, Mr. Flagg.
Yes,
You spoke about your grandfather. Speak about an intervention. Speak about your family. A few minutes to the
Okay, listen. Well, my dad is one of 12. Obviously, my grandfather was a prominent anesthesiologist. He wrote several books, The Art of Anesthesia. He was the main doctor at Manhattan Eye, Ear, Nose, and Throat, and invented a laryngoscope. You can Google it. It's called the FLAGG, F-L-A-G-G, laryngoscope.
Yeah.
And he was very close to Archbishop Fulton Sheen. And the reason he became very close with Archbishop Fulton Sheen is that as a young doctor, he went to Haiti and treated the leopards down there.
Mm-hmm.
And he got instilled in a lot of flags that we need to do more volunteer work, that kind of stuff. And so he went to Archbishop Fulton Sheen, and he started the Catholic Medical Mission Board. That particular board currently gives out over $290 million worth of medical supplies all over the world. It's funded, obviously, because, you know, his patents are still involved. They also had a place on 17th Street, and they sold that, so they're able to buy more medical supplies for the needy. My dad, being one of 12, I have 55 first cousins on the flag side. My immediate family is just my sister and my brother. So you can imagine the other were very prolific Catholics. So my grandfather was one of two doctors that delivered the Lindbergh baby. And he was very, very close to Charles Lindbergh. There's footage of Lindbergh at my grandfather's house in Yonkers. And during the course of his relationship with Lindbergh, Lindbergh went to Germany. He was, he was an idol. I mean, people would go, hundreds of thousands of people would go to where he was. But he had actually toured Germany during the early 30s and was impressed by their aircraft and their facilities. And I think he was a German sympathizer, but that's just my opinion. But my grandfather got a notion from Lindbergh that this person, Hermann the German, was called back to Germany in 1935 and that my grandfather, due to the fact he had 12 kids, want to buy this property on an island off the coast of Maine called Vinalhaven, V-I-N-A-L-H-A-V-E-N. And so it's from 1935 forward, my dad and his brothers and sisters would go to this compound at a mile of waterfront property. And basically Hermann the German left it intact furniture. There was an upper and lower house. There was a barn. The original barn is still there. There were four or five other houses on chicken coops, that kind of stuff. And I remember as a little boy, my mom, as more and more of the Flag clan would come into existence, we would go and spend summers there. It then stopped, and then eventually we divvied up property, and I would say out of my cousins, we probably have 25 houses that are located there, summer places. One particular cousin has bought the lower and upper house and actually has a working farm on Vinalhaven. He retired there. So my first aunt at Virginia Flag, my grandfather said, "You're going to be a nun." Obviously, she was Catholicized, and the firstborn male, my Uncle Tao, he was supposed to be a priest. And so my Aunt Virginia joins the Maryknoll Order, and in 1935 she shipped out to China to teach English to the Chinese in Nanking. And unbeknownst to me at the time, she was arrested, raped, like every other prisoner, and then repatriated. They did a prisoner swap, and she was located in Hong Kong and spent years in Hong Kong, and then was transferred to Hawaii. And from Hawaii, she went to Chinatown in New York. So when she was 80 years old, she retired and was in Maryknoll, which is in upstate New York. There's a retirement facility there for both priests and nuns. And so I would go up and I said, look, I have two daughters who are 40 and 38 now, but back in when she was 90, they were young ladies that were in college, and I said, you need to meet this remarkable person, and I need to do some FBI interviews. That's really what happened. So at first, it was just the four of us. We would go up and have dinner with her at her birthday. Her birthday was October 8th. Mine's October 10th. So we would celebrate our birthdays together. I'd get her, and we'd take her to dinner and drive her back to Maryknoll. And I said, look, Aunt Virginia, you're over 90, I think. You know, when you hit 90, why are we waiting for one whole turn around the sun? Let's do a half a turn around the sun, and we'll have a birthday twice a year. We celebrated her birthday twice, in May and in October.
Isn't that beautiful?
Awesome.
So you get a kick out of this story. So in 95, it had expanded, you know, by word of mouth. There were probably 35 of the 300 relatives in the New York area. And we would all get together for her May birthday and also for her real birthday. And this was her real birthday, and I'm sitting next to her, and I said, so Aunt Virginia, what are you doing tomorrow? She's 95 years old. And she said, well, I'm going to a Notre Dame football game. And I said, what? Do you even know who they playing? I interrupt. I go, who are they playing? He goes, oh, it's homecoming, and we're playing USC. And I said, well, how are you getting out there? She says, oh, I'm flying on a private jet. I said, what? She said, yeah, that's, no, Dr. Who, W-H-O-O, Dr. Who is going to fly us out. And I go, how you? Yeah, I've been going since she retired. She picks me up at her private jet, and you know, I spend the whole week with her. And I go, wait, right there. And somehow, the year's 1998, I bumped into Digger Phelps, who was the former coach, basketball coach at Notre Dame. I call him up. I go, Coach, is there a Doctor Who out there? And he, oh yeah, does she have a lot of money? Oh yeah, she's a better. Is a better box than the chancellor at Notre Dame. I said, does she give out scholarships? He goes, oh, yeah, 4 a year. I said, 4 a year? I said, there's out of 55 flags, none of us have gone to Notre Dame. So I walked back in. I said, hey, Virginia, do you think you could have, you know, one of the flags on the arm with Dr. Williams? So I never thought of that. Nor did she invite us on the plane. So I've never seen a Notre Dame football game, and neither has any of my 300 other relatives. But I will tell you this, when she did pass, Dr. Wu flew in, gave the eulogy, and she told a remarkable story. And when she was taken out of China, she smuggled Dr. Wu's parents to Hong Kong. They became extremely rich, and she was the head of the business school in Notre Dame.
Wow.
Amazing.
That's amazing.
Amazing lady.
That's outstanding.
And I'll give you another crazy thing. Up in Vinyl Haven, my grandfather made a, we have our own cemetery, the Flag Cemetery, okay? All of her brothers and sisters and any other relative that has passed away, they all get buried there. So Iphigenia is there, and I said, Iphigenia, obviously you're going to go up in Maine and get buried with your brothers and sisters. And she said, oh, no, I'm going to show you where I got buried, where I'm going to get buried. Where is this? So get in a motorized wheelchair, and we go behind Maryknoll, and there's a whole area of fallen nuns. And she says, I'm going to get buried right there. And I said, why are you going to get buried there and not with your relatives? And she said, because when God comes back, this is the first place he's going to be. So I went into my FBI car, took out my grave marker, and put it right next to her. I said, I'm going to get buried there. She about came out of her wheelchair.
That's a wonderful, wonderful story. Oh,
yeah,
goodness.
No, she was unbelievable. What a lady.
Listen,
never once did she ever say a bad word.
Wow.
Could not, being as trained as I am, she said, they would interview us and say, do you believe in the war? I believe in the God. Never once. And I had been to Maryknoll. She wrote Maryknoll tons of letters, and they kept them all. We've been reading them for the family.
Isn't
about different adventures. Yeah, it's unbelievable. She's way, way ahead of me.
That's wonderful. Thank you for sharing that wonderful history. Listen, your wife, I want to bring her in. She attended the 60th anniversary dinner of Master Abdullah Majid Karim Hassan, of which you were one of the honorees. Murad Muhammad was one of the hosts, and
correct.
Your wife stated that it was one of the greatest affairs that she attended honoring her husband. Can you elaborate on that?
Okay, so Pat doesn't participate in a lot of things that I do. Okay, she's a former prosecutor in the Eastern District. So, needless to say, I haven't won an argument yet. But, you never want to be cross-examined by, you know, a criminal defense attorney, okay? It's just, it's impossible to get across your point of view or anything else. But we went to the ceremony. It was all over the top. She is very, very close. Just for your listeners' information. Over the years, people on my block in Brooklyn would have Christmas Eve, New Year's Eve with Sonia Sotomayor. She lived on our block.
Wow.
And she is a dear, dear friend. Okay? So you can imagine I knew her when she was just a federal judge and all that, and it's just amazing. But we have socialized for years and years. In any event, obviously, being lawyers, when they get together, you know, I'm the odd man out. She went to this ceremony, and what Murad said and what I said and what Jimmy Bin said and everybody else, and it was a spectacular affair, was mind-boggling to her, her terms, how the community could listen to a white FBI agent. That is radicalized. This is off the charts. And I think she was as impressed with what I said as much as what Murad said about the award. I hope that captured it, because she was blown away. And it's been a while that I could say that, okay? And we've been in the presence of some pretty interesting people. She, a story about Sonia Sotomayor, you'll get a kick out of this, is a place on Court Street in Brooklyn called Prime Eats. And so she says, calls up and says, look, I don't want to hang out for New Year's in Washington, D.C. Can we go to a place where we can just have dinner and, you know, I won't be inundated. I have, you know, people with marshals that have to take me, and we need to know the whole crew, and I want to eat the last meal, that kind of stuff. So we go to Prime Meats, and they were kind enough to give us a list of all the people that had made reservations for New Year's Eve. And we had a spectacular dinner. And on the way out, she was saying hi to the owners. And there's a little step from the dining room to the bar area. And she turned and was waving to somebody and missed the step, fell and hit her, landed on the windowsill. And, you know, we're all in a line because it's packed and, you don't know why we're being held up. But all we see is her being sideways, being thrown in the car like she was shot or something. And so we're all concerned. We didn't know what happened. And just then, Jay-Z and Beyonce pull up with their entourage because they wanted to come to the bar. And so guns were pulled all over the place. We had no idea. It was unbelievable. So she went to the hospital and had a broken rib, and you know, everything was settled down. But she's an incredibly dear friend.
She's one of my favorite people. This is such an honor. She is one of my favorite people, and I have followed her, you know, all the way to the Supreme Court, and just an outstanding human being. And here you are, Fred. This is absolutely an honor.
I have purchased probably 20 of her books and had them personally signed to my grandkids and to my friends and that kind of stuff with a note, because I think she's, you know, it's amazing to be so honored. I mean, just to have letters back and forth in which she says, say hi to my wife and you, and we miss you, and we'll see you, and that kind of thing. So we haven't been together due to the pandemic, so I'm hoping that this year things will open up. And I hope you guys, all your listeners, I say this from the bottom of my heart, I had COVID. You need to get the shots. We need to do what the president says so that we can protect the young, and especially the people in the communities that can't get out, Red Hook, Gowanus, the projects. They need to have these people so that you can go in and give these people who are bedridden or don't want to leave their project, get them the shot so that they don't pass away. That's my pulpit statement.
We give many shows regarding this, and thank you for your commentary. We appreciate commentary from all backgrounds. We appreciate that. The final thoughts. Shawna, you have any questions for final thoughts?
Okay. Well, I would say I would love to follow up with you, Fred Mann.
Call me anytime, even after the program is over. And if any of your listeners want to talk, you put your requests into this program, and I will answer.
Awesome.
Excellent.
Just such a fountain of energy and stories, and it's just wonderful to talk to you. You have such wisdom and such an incredible background. I'd love to talk to you more about, you know, the art of asking the right questions.
That is a key. And my last comment is about 9/11, and I could get into this, but we'll do it on another show. 9/11 succinctly could have been prevented had 50 people inside the CIA notified the FBI that the hijackers were in the country. Now, the damage, not only the 3,000-plus lives that were lost that day, plus the firefighters, the first responders, plus the family members who have been hurt, the mothers, the daughters, the aunts, the uncles, okay? Then we go into Afghanistan, we go into Iraq, We have spent billions and billions of dollars for no reason. No reason. Personal gain, in my opinion.
In fact,
I can explain why that government stuff.
I do want you to come back.
It'll be my pleasure.
And what we'll do, we will start off with that subject. And, you know, I want to talk about, you know, this whole 9/11 occurrence. You know, now we have the invisible cell. How do we fight this? You know, I definitely want you to come back, and we will start off with this because there is more to be discussed, and I want to be able to take our time. So thank you.
Well, I want you all, just one last thing. It's the 20th anniversary this year.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that. 20 years, like it was yesterday.
Yes, sir.
So I'll be honored to speak about this. There is a program on Hulu called Looming Tower, which gives you the background. Looming Tower.
I'll watch that before we do our next interview.
I trained Ali Sofan. So there's a whole story, and I still stay with him. I still talk to him on a regular basis. And he left the FBI due to the abuses of waterboarding, et cetera. And it goes back to your niece's question, which is, how do we ask the right question? Because that's where you gain the trust and you get the information that is important to whatever you're asking. Police, the FBI, a teacher in school, you name it. Training, training, training.
My cousin, his name is Eugene Carmichael, and he was an attorney in Texas for many, many decades. He was a graduate of Howard University Law and NYU. He has since transitioned and passed away. But he recommended early on, thank you. He recommended very early on when I was completing my undergraduate. And, you know, he was just a phenomenal human being. And it was so funny because he loved to go to bookstores. He loved books, and I loved books. And he would recommend this book to me and my siblings and so forth. And it was The Art of Speaking, and or The Art of Public Speaking. And there's a science involved with that. And I always appreciated that text because it really gave you the format and the meaning of speaking. So when you ask the type of questions or interviews, and you understand what the person is saying to you in the underlying messages versus and making that a more direct conversation in real time. So thank you. We'll talk about that more. Thank you, Shauna, for being with us. We'll talk about that more in the future when we have you back on.
Thanks for having me.
Shauna, give me a call. God bless you both. Stay healthy. Please.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Your aunt has my contact information. Just go for it.
Thank you. It's
great.
Thank you. Have a wonderful day. Blessed day. Shauna, if you would give individuals your information to reach you, an email is fine, or whatever communication you have, website.
Sure. You can reach me at shaunacarbro.com. That's S-H-A-W-N-A, Tarboro, T-A as in Tom, A-R, B as in boy, O-R-O.com.
Thank you so much. Thank you to the listening audience. This has been a remarkable Saturday morning. We thank our honored guest, Mr. William Warren Flagg, excuse me, Mr. Warren Flagg.
No, the flag man.
The flag man. Okay. The flag man.
Yeah.
In case there's any FBI agents out there listening, they'll know who I am.
Thank you, Shauna. The alumni University of Arizona today, ladies and gentlemen. And
thank you, Ron.
This program is sponsored by New Africa Excellent Alliance Speech. Thank you for joining us today. You may reach me at jlimahmoh77@gmail.com. Thank you all, and have a blessed day. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.